Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career. Well, welcome to Speaking of Reliability. Hey, Tim, good morning.
Good morning, Fred.
And, well, we haven't talked in a little while, and we just got done with our 100th episode, which, we had some quality issues and audio issues, so hopefully people bared with us on that one. But it was a nice milestone to put down. So, well, thanks, Tim, for participating in so many of these different recordings.
It's been a great pleasure participating.
Yeah. And you know that you're the token supply chain guy, so it's, you know, we don't have a software engineer in the group, so it's always your fault. It's always the vendor's fault.
You mean you can't blame the software, so you have to blame the vendor? Is that right?
That's right. That's
okay.
Right. What we really need is maybe we could talk about buying software. Then we have it both in the same category.
I like it.
Yeah. But I guess it is a real topic, though, is that on occasion, and I know you've seen it and I've seen it, and I know many of our listeners have experienced this, is that you're in production, or you maybe are looking at field returns or whatever, and you recognize that there is a batch of parts that you received from one of your suppliers that were bad, that were out of spec or didn't meet requirements or whatever, but they got through the system somehow and failed in the field. Or they failed in your factory or wherever it happened. Now, what I've seen is the natural tendency is counter to a lot of what you and I have talked about in the show of building a partnership, that you're in business together. That's, you know, what's good for one side is good for the other, and all this good stuff to create a viable, reliable product. But the first inclination is you get a failure is you bag it up and ship it to them, and then you call them and yell at them.
Right. You know, that's page one of the supplier management handbook, right?
Yeah, it's just, and you know, people are upset. They're disappointed. There's lots of emotional reasons for some of the response we see. Yet we've also seen some really good give and take and back and forth, and it's recognizing that, hey, there's an issue here and we need to solve it. And instead of just immediately casting blame. But you know, I don't think a contract can cover this.
Yeah. You really don't want to rely on the purchase order or the contract as a way of enforcing quality. That's not what I recommend, at least. I mean, certainly having good terms and conditions written into your purchase order will make sure that any warranty costs or any damages that are incurred as a result are, you know, dealt with in a manner that's already been negotiated. So that's, I don't want to undervalue that. Mm-hmm. But if your goal here is to fix the problem and prevent similar problems from happening in the future, sticking to a strategy of just enforcing a contract is not the way to go. It really starts, Fred, I think it really depends on when in the, evolution of this part, the development of this part, when is this failure happening? Is this happening during kind of the early design stages, or is this happening after the design has been released to production and you're in full production mode? Mm-hmm. And the reason I make that distinction is that there are, you know, I can think of off the top of my head at least three possible causes of a defective product received from a supplier. And one of them is the design. Has the design been proven? Mm-hmm. And has it been proven at the levels of production that you need from your supplier?
Oh, you're talking about the product coming from the vendor. Is their design proven?
Yeah, or how much, well, it depends on who's responsible for the design, right? I mean, if the supplier is simply building something according to a print, according to drawings or schematics that you have provided, you need to ask yourself whether the design itself is the cause of the defect.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I was thinking it was also sometimes the part, when we put it into a board or into an assembly.
Right.
It's the victim. It's not the cause of the problem.
Good point. Good point.
But let's say we isolate it to the part isn't as expected. So what you're saying is that whether we designed the part, gave them the drawings and specification, or the vendor did, well, is it the right specifications?
Yeah.
For
is the
application?
Problem with the design itself?
Right.
I think that's a question you need to ask. And that's why I make a distinction between if this is a design that's already been validated, it's been proven, you know, it's been confirmed at the levels of production that you need. So the reason I make that distinction, Fred, is that if you just get one part from a supplier and it works, that's hardly it shouldn't give you full confidence that this can be done at higher levels of production.
Right.
You see what I mean?
Right.
That it's just a small sample size, right? So you need to have a production ramp where you can verify that the supplier can make this thing in higher quantities. So again, assuming that the design has been verified, that you have confidence that the design, whether design came from you or came from the supplier, either way, assuming that that's been validated. Now we're looking at two other possible causes. So maybe it's one cause would be that there's really a problem with workmanship at your supplier. In other words, mm-hmm. Their processes have failed to deliver what you're looking for.
Well, okay? It's the process control, just out of control situation, or maybe they're just not capable and you have some percentage that fall outside of some specification.
Which is also a possibility. I mean, we haven't talked about acceptance sampling yet, but mm-hmm. it is possible that that the lot, let's assume that you received a lot of material from your supplier and you pull a sample from that lot to do acceptance testing. There are some good guidelines that have been published. The AQL guidelines are the ones that I'm thinking of. I don't know if you're familiar with those.
We'll have to have another discussion about how good those are. But
but it basically determines what sample size you need to pull from a particular lot and how many units from that sample are allowed to be defective before you are justified in rejecting the entire lot.
Mm-hmm,
okay.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so we'll talk about that in a future episode. But assuming that you've got enough defective units to reject the whole lot, then that's when you've got to dig deeper and you've got to say, hey, this isn't just a statistical anomaly. This really is a sign that there's something else going on. And that's when you need to look at process control.
Well, there's the old, my dad used to ask the dealer. I was with him when he bought a car one time and he was ordering a car, but he specified he did not want a car built on Friday.
Yeah.
It's like, you can control that? And I'm like 10 years old or something like that, huh?
Right.
Does that make a difference? But I've seen it where we've worked with suppliers where they move the factory across the campus or to a new country, and we can tell.
Yeah.
We can measure the increase in variability and the change in the materials. Due to some change, and it could be a shift change, it could be a line change, it could be a process improvement that went awry, all kinds of reasons that...
These are classic examples of what we call special causes, and it's the responsibility of the supplier to understand and eliminate the influence of those special causes. So we're trying to make a distinction here between special causes and common causes, but it's a very good point.
Well, the common causes, though, is that what we see is that and I had recently was working with a mechanical part where it was a pretty elaborate construction of this mm-hmm. part, a very high precision piece of and pretty tough material and to work with. And they just were not capable of holding the specifications. It's just beyond the technical capability of the supplier.
Right.
And so they resorted to a sorting routine.
Oh, my gosh.
Which is kind of a worst case to get what you need. But
It is. I always – I know we talked a little bit about incoming inspection before. What you're talking about is basically outbound inspection, which is incrementally better. It's an improvement over incoming inspection because at least it's not your resources, your people that are tied up doing the inspection.
Yeah.
But it's – I say it's only incrementally an improvement. It's not recommended. It's much better to figure out what the root cause is. But again, this is the kind of thing that really should be verified before you go into full production.
Mm-hmm.
That this is – it's the – We use early deliveries from the supplier to help verify the design, but then we need to build up to higher levels of production so that we can verify their production process to make sure that they have the level of process control that they need in order to reliably produce this product at volume, you know, over an extended period of time. And then if we see a problem after that, after they've hit the higher levels of production, then that indicates to us that, the first thing I would ask is if there are special causes, you know, as you said, are there things like moving the factory or bringing in a whole new crop of technicians or operators, you know, to work the process? Has there been a process change? Once you've convince yourself you have high enough level of confidence that they can do it at production volumes.
Well, part of that is, and I've seen this in my own factories that I've worked in and with suppliers, is that there's a lot of excitement of bringing up a new line and getting a new design up and running and bringing up all the new equipment and all the training and all that stuff. And 6 months later, it's old news. It's old hat. It's that's where we put the younger engineers. That's where
we put
the new hires, and there's no focus. There's not a lot of people watching what's going on or paying attention to it, or it's just routine,
right?
And the knowledge and care and diligence erodes, and then we end up with these special causes,
right?
I think I told you the story about the guy with the AC/DC shirt and was breaking. It was the carriage board on the inkjet printers.
I don't remember that.
Yeah. You know, the carriage board, it had a bunch of big e-caps on one end of it. And it was just a small, like 2-inch by 3-inch type board. And they had breakoff tabs. They panelized them for production. And they would break out into pairs. And so if you grab the e-caps on both sides and just flex the whole thing, you'd break them. And it's not recommended because it bows the entire board and breaks all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
And so I saw, I was visiting one of the factories in Guadalajara, and I noticed a bus pull up. And all these people are getting off, and I'm like, wow, you guys asked my hostess, that's pretty cool. You transport your employees in, and goes, oh, no, we don't do that. Those are new hires from the job center in town. We're growing so fast, we're busing new hires in every day. Mm-hmm. You know, and then, of course, they spent, you know, 45 slides talking about how wonderful their training program is and qualification program and certification and employee. They don't get on your products until they're checked out and all that stuff. So finally, we get on the floor, and there's this kid with the AC/DC shirt. I'm like, okay. And he's breaking these boards apart in free air. Just grab the big components and flexes it and bends it apart.
Yeah.
And you could hear the cracking from 20 feet away.
Sure.
And
now, these were scored, right?
They were little tabs, just two little breakoff tabs.
Okay.
And so they were supposed to be, you know, put in a fixture and then a knife run across them, basically.
Yeah.
And or some other, I think we ended up using routers after that. But I was like, okay, well, so much. I looked at the quality manager, and so much for all your talk about training and qualification.
Yeah.
I saw him get off the bus this morning, and that's causing problems that we're looking for.
Yeah. And again, like you said, this is a classic situation. A process is stable. It's perceived to be stable. And then what suppliers will do is they'll try to find a way to run it at lower cost.
Mm-hmm.
And so they'll try to look for ways to reduce the expenses associated with that process and continue to skate closer and closer to the edge, hoping that their cost reductions are not going to create a quality catastrophe on your side.
And we do the same in our own factories.
Sure.
Yeah.
We shouldn't be surprised when that happens. We've talked, Fred, before about, you know, that these suppliers are businesses and they're looking for ways to improve their operating expenses so that they can improve their profits. So, again, we've talked about this problem, whether the issue is the design or whether the issue has to do with the supplier itself. And again, I want to emphasize the need to qualify the design to make sure we verify that the design as is, based on drawings or schematics or whatever, provides the necessary functionality. And in this case, we're talking about quality and reliability mm-hmm. as well in your final product. So if we're satisfied that it's not the design, because we've done all that qualification in advance, then really the only thing that's left is something that's happening on the supplier side. And again, it could be something that they're doing within their own factory. And then the third thing that I wanted to point out that our listeners may be waiting for is it may be an issue with the supplier's supplier.
Now, it's still we've seen that a few times.
Right. So it's still the supplier's responsibility to manage their own suppliers. So they're not off the hook just because it's a supplier's supplier problem.
Some of those are not just the first supplier to our suppliers, our second level down. It can go back to raw materials in some cases.
It can. It's getting harder and harder as supply chains become more extended and it becomes a very complex network.
Well, there was the one case where it was the flame retardant that was used in the epoxy overmolding for some components.
Yeah.
Somebody changed the screen size of the particle size and made it a little bit bigger, but it crossed the threshold where the epoxy component would not hold that size component in the mesh, basically.
Right.
And so with a little bit of vibration, characteristic of inside a spinning hard disk, those very corrosive flame retardant materials, I'm forgetting what the name of that material was, would come out of the epoxy and then it would land usually in the worst possible place and cause all kinds of corrosion and failures. But that was like five steps away from, because it was, we're building hard drives, we're buying linear digital chips of some sort that are epoxy overmolded by a packaging house that buys the chips from a fab that buys the epoxy from an epoxy vendor who buys the flame retardant material from a flame retardant vendor.
So Fred, just think about what you're saying and come back to your original question. We get a defective product from a supplier and we fire off an angry email or an angry phone call to the supplier. The example you just described required, I'm sure, an incredible amount of failure analysis work, mm-hmm. root cause analysis work. I'm guessing that took months to get to the bottom of that one.
No, that was I ran into that when I was at HP. So we sent it off. We sent our drives to the lab, and Ralph in like 2 days came back and said, here's the source of the corrosion and this is the likely place it's coming from. He said, I don't know why it's coming from there. But within a week, we knew what we were looking for. And so we went back to the chip manufacturer, the components that were in that area that were the likely candidates. And they were getting news back from other people also. Right? And so it was a class across all of their epoxy components, tens of thousands, if not millions of components were affected.
Well, I guess my point is that, instead of firing off an angry email or phone call to the supplier, I mean, let's collaborate to figure out what the root cause is.
And that was the nature of the phone call. Here's what we're seeing. Here's what we're experiencing. Do you have any ideas? It was like brainstorming at the start. What could be doing this and what can we do to stop it?
Right. Instead of relying on terms and conditions in your purchase order and saying, look, you people screwed up, you need to pay. Again, you may need to fall back on that. You may truly have damages and warranty costs. You may have line shutdowns. or other kinds of negative consequences as a result of this poor quality. But that's not how you improve quality going forward. It's already happened. Yeah. You've incurred the costs. Hey, let's be proactive. Let's try to figure out how to avoid these kind of things in the future.
And that's, you know, once we got past the sales teams and the program managers and lawyers to some extent, and the engineers get together and say, all right, how are we going to solve this?
Right.
You want to get to that as quick as possible.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Then, and that's, it's hard to get past that emotional part to start with. It's easy to point a finger. And as much as people internal to their own organization try to avoid blaming anybody, it seems so readily easy to do with vendors. And that's something to guard against.
It is. And again, there's a tendency to point fingers. I guess what we need to do is really assess the likelihood that the supplier could have prevented this in the first place. What is their engineering capability and how well do they really understand their own processes? Mm-hmm. Have we chosen a supplier in order to save money? But we chose them because they gave us a low cost. And at the time, we were willing to overlook the fact that they don't have a lot of strength in their own, you know, process control capabilities. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the reason I say that is because we may, again, bear some of the blame, even though the supplier may have caused this issue. Were we willing to overlook certain deficiencies in the supplier when we chose them to make this part in the first place?
That's right.
And this comes back to the idea of total cost or cost of quality. Mm-hmm. Should we accept some of the blame here because we were willing to, you know, we went with the lowest bid?
Yeah, there's plenty of blame to go around. And I remember my mom's adage, if you point a finger at somebody, realize that you got three other fingers pointing right back at you.
Yeah. So should we be surprised when we get lousy quality from the supplier? Do they really understand their own processes well enough?
Well, there's lots of reasons why it happens. And I think we can control our own response. So
yes.
It's a matter of, all right, let's sit on the same side of the table. Let's solve this. And like you said right at the start, is how do we prevent it from happening in the future?
Right.
And so some of it is just awareness. Some of it might be training. Some of it might be a different supplier.
It could be. Switching the supplier is an option. It may not be an easy option. But if you get enough of these kinds of quality issues over time, you're perfectly justified in switching suppliers, just understanding that there is a switching cost.
Yeah, which isn't a different gamut is to threaten them, is that if they do this again, we're going to cancel their account.
Right.
That's not a good opening gamut.
Not an opening gamut. But, you know, again, they need to understand that what your quality expectations are. And this is a component of your supplier selection process. Mm-hmm. That failure to perform in this area of quality will be grounds for, you know, loss of future business. They need to understand that that is a credible threat.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think it does happen. And I think thinking through oftentimes as the reliability engineer, we find these issues in various parts of the life cycle. And in some cases, especially when it's a field issue, is we certainly get involved with dealing with it, to working mm-hmm. with the supply chain people and with our suppliers to resolve the issue.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's our goal, then you have a number of different ways to approach it. But what you outlined, Tim, was three different ways that these problems can occur. So it provides us kind of a checklist to think through, you know, where do we go look for the solution for this particular issue?
Yes.
Yeah. All right. Well, we mentioned incoming inspection a couple of times, and I've taken a deep breath every time going, I really don't like incoming inspection. But let's come back and talk about that. It's another topic worthy of discussion. And my notes here is that it's a necessary evil. So.
Yes. Unfortunately.
So we'll leave it there as a cliffhanger for the next episode.
Okay, Fred.
Okay.
Sounds good.
All right. So if, thanks for listening to the Speaking of Reliability series, and Tim and I and the others have enjoyed creating these short episodes and so on. So please join the discussion and leave us a rating and review on iTunes. It really helps us, one, to get some feedback, and two, to let other people know about the show. But if you'd like us to talk about a particular circumstance, or if you'd like to join us in this discussion, you know, let us know. Send us an email. You can find our contact info and variety of ways to contact us at reliability.fm. And we look forward to hearing from you. So with that, Tim, let's sign off for this one.
Thanks a lot, Fred.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.